daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Hello and welcome to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Coming up, General Secretary Xi Jinping of the Communist Party of China's Central Committee meets with Ma Ying-jeou in Beijing. How significant is it to cross-strait relations? U.S. and Japan announced new military agreements. Is Japan shifting away from its pacifist stance? South Korean Prime Minister offers to resign after election defeat. What factors have contributed to the ruling party's defeat? General Secretary Xi Jinping of the Communist Party of China's Central Committee has met with former Kuomintang Party Chairman Ma Ying-jeou in Beijing. Xi Jinping said people on both sides of the Taiwan Strait belong to the Chinese nation. He said the nation's history records the inseparable ties between the compatriots across the strait, and external forces could not stop the process of national reunification. He also stressed the importance of cross-strait youth exchanges, saying that the Chinese nation will only prosper when young people thrive. He called on the two sides to approach cross-strait relations by addressing the interests of the Chinese nation as a whole and its long-term development. Ma Ying-jeou said that adhering to the 1992 consensus and opposing Taiwan independence are the common political foundation for the peaceful development of cross-strait ties. He also affirmed that people on both sides of the strait belong to the Chinese nation and should deepen exchanges and promote Chinese culture. Ma is leading a group of students on an 11-day visit to the Chinese mainland. Taiwan Affairs Office spokesperson Zhu Fenglian said the Chinese mainland will continue to provide favorable conditions for exchanges between youths from both sides of the Taiwan Strait. For more, I talked to Liu Kuangyu, researcher at Institute of Taiwan Studies at Chinese Academy of Social Science.
What do you make of the significance of this meeting between President Xi Jinping and Ma Ying-jeou?
Well, the political significance of this meeting, I think, is very rich, and there are at least three aspects we should focus on. The first is I think it's a confirmation of the common political foundation of the two sides of the straits, which includes the basic identification the two sides of Taiwan Straits are belonging to the same Chinese nation, one China, and also the recognition of the 1992 consensus and the political consensus against Taiwan's so-called independence, as well as the confirmation of the responsibilities and missions shared by the two sides of the Taiwan Strait. And secondly, it's the resonance of the mainstream consensus of cross-strait public opinion for peace, for exchange and prosperity, and positive call for compatriots on both sides of the Taiwan Strait to work together and to seek national reunification. As we can see, the DPP authorities, which pursued the so-called policy line of rejecting unification by force and inviting war, are facing the dilemma of a double minority in Taiwan right now, as the mainstream public opinion on the island is looking forward to cross-strait peace, exchange and prosperity, which is also the same social opinion represented by Mr. Ma Ying-jeou's trip. And furthermore, I think it demonstrates to the international community that the Chinese people on both sides of the Taiwan Straits have the full will and wisdom to sit down and talk through extensive political and democratic consultations to settle our own domestic affairs and to place the destiny of the Chinese nation firmly in the hands of our Chinese people.
Well, how is Ma Ying-jeou's trip to the mainland, especially his meeting with President Xi, being viewed by people on both sides of the Taiwan Strait?
Well, Mr. Ma's visit has received a great deal of attention from society and public opinion on both sides of the Taiwan Strait. For the mainland side, the public is generally highly welcomes Ma's visit to the motherland and has pretty high expectations for Mr. Ma to move more clearly promote cross-strait reconciliation, integration, and reunification. And on the island, Mr. Ma is also a very good guide, a good teacher and messenger who's spreading to the island the common historical culture and national identity across the strait through his own words and actions on the Chinese mainland, introducing the mainland's new quality productive force and the latest progress in cross-strait integration and development, as well as transmitting the mainland's goodwill and new political signals back towards Taiwan. And with the exceptions of a small number of green populists, the mainstream public opinion in Taiwan, including many political parties, highly positive about Mr. Ma's trip. We believe that Mr. Ma's trip will also produce a good ice-breaking, path-finding and demonstration effect, driving more knowledgeable people from all walks of life on the island to devote themselves to future cross-strait exchanges.
Okay, and President Xi said that people on both sides of the strait share the same bloodline, culture and history, as well as the same responsibility for the nation and the same aspiration for the future. I mean, how important are those commonalities in cross-strait relations, and what specific aspiration was he referring to?
Well, at the core of these commonalities is the fact that the two sides of the Taiwan Strait belong to one people and one country. And this is the most fundamental basis, condition, and source of motivation for the pursuit of peace, of development, integration, and reunification across the Taiwan Strait. From this point of view, our common expectations, responsibilities is that the Chinese people on both sides of Taiwan Strait should unite to firmly guard the common homeland of Chinese nation, to continue our 5,000-year-old beliefs of traditions that the country cannot be divided, the nation cannot be separated and dispirited, and the civilization cannot be broken up, so as to jointly build a strong and unified nation and realize the Chinese dream of a great reunification, rejuvenation of the Chinese nation together.
Yeah, and Xi Jinping emphasized the need to view the cross-strait situation from the perspective of the overall interests and long-term development of the Chinese nation. What do you make of this?
Well, I think President Xi's rhetoric provides two very important perspectives for us to better understand and present the future of cross-strait relationship and to better grasp the historical mission undertaken by Chinese compatriots on both sides of the Taiwan Strait. The first is to safeguard our overall interests of Chinese nation and to see that the two sides of the strait are the community of shared destiny, with the mainland and Taiwan sharing the same loss and same glory, rather than being divided and opposed to each other. At present, the most crucial, fundamental, and important interest is to resolutely oppose the secession of Taiwan independence and promote the peaceful reunification of the of our homeland. And in the long run, as General Secretary Xi Jinping has said, we must determine to create long-term well-being of the Chinese nation, which is the starting the ending point of the for the development of cross-strait relations. I think we will take the lead in sharing with our compatriots the opportunities, better opportunities provided by Chinese-style modernization, and sharing the fruits of the motherland's development and progress, and actively doing practical, good, and difficult work for our Taiwan compatriots so that they can enjoy more benefits, more real well-being, and better future, and to create better future together with the Chinese compatriots for our common future.
Mm-hmm. And Xi Jinping said there are no knots that cannot be united, no issue that cannot be discussed, and no force that can separate us. How to interpret this statement?
Yes, I think this shows that mainland has the wisdom that we are able to rationally view and correctly deal with some of the misunderstandings and differences that has existed between the two sides of the Taiwan Strait over the past 70 years as a result of the so-called the objective division and artificially created by the political isolation article created and confrontations on the island. But we believe that this does not constitute a substantive obstacle to China's reunification, nor can it change the objective fact that the two sides of the strait belong to the same country and the same people. As the saying goes, when brothers are united, they can defend themselves against external insults. So consensus and unity between the two sides of the strait in this regard is the key to resisting the interference by external forces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but what do you think are the biggest sources of external interference in cross-strait relations, and how might they be addressed?
Well, at present, the most important external forces interfering in the Taiwan Strait question, I think, are the United States and Japan, those two countries. While the former is the overall promoter and organizer and programmer of external interference into China's internal affairs, and Japan has been also actively playing the role of some sort of a vanguard or a sharpshooter in recent years, and has even tried to pull the United States and its allies to intervene even further into the Taiwan Strait to a certain extent. And I think the two sides have recently been cooperated with each other and joined forces to systematically and continuously create a large number of risks and risks of undermining the status quo on both sides of the straits, encouraging the forces of Taiwan independence on the island, and impeding the process of China's peaceful reunification.
Yeah, and also there are reports about Japan potentially joining the AUKUS Security Pact and upgrading security ties with the U.S., coupled with the recent trilateral meeting between the U.S., Japan, and the Philippines. It appears that the U.S. is intensifying efforts to forge alliance to counter China in the region. So how do you think these developments might affect regional stability and cross-strait relations?
Right, we can see the U.S. and Japan are holding high-profile talks between the heads of state, not only to strengthen the Japan-U.S. military cooperation, creating a major upgrade of so-called anti-China alliance structure in the so-called Indo-Pacific region, and further loosening the military ties for Japan, but also to join hands with some Asia-Pacific countries to engage in a so-called small circle with the intention of creating tensions and confrontation to see the strategic interests. This is intended to create tensions and confrontations in pursuit of strategic interests, and is bound to undermine regional peace and stability. The Asia-Pacific region, I think, should be a high ground for peaceful development and should not be a chessboard or a chess game for big powers. So if the United States, Japan, or also the Philippines cooperate with each other to engage in confrontation between political camps and competition amongst major powers, I would not only seriously jeopardize regional peace and stability, also Chinese national sovereignty and interests, but will also be detrimental to their own security and development in the end.
Yeah, and also, what role do you think youth from both sides of the Taiwan Strait can play in shaping the future of cross-strait relations?
Yes, youth, they are very important for the mass trip this time. And we also know that the results of the two elections in Taiwan earlier this year shows that the role of island's young generation is becoming more and more important. So, and this is also the important force that will influence the development of cross relations in the future. President Xi Jinping has pointed out that when the youth rise, the country rises. So when the youth are strong, the country is strong. The future of the motherland of our nation, of cross relations, rests on the youth people. Strengthening cross youth exchanges, for example, and its communication can add new energy and inject youthful vigor into the peaceful development of cross relations. Also, we see the closer the cross-strait youth exchanges are, the more it will help to eliminate the prejudices, the misunderstandings of Taiwan's youth against the motherland, and break down the barriers between the youth and on both sides of the strait, and also allow more Taiwan youth to reacquaint themselves with and integrate into the motherland, so that the youth on both sides of the strait will be more motivated to join hands to fight for the future and create a more glorious prospect for national reunification.
That's Liu Kengyu, researcher at Institute of Taiwan Studies at Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. You're listening to World Today. Stay with us. You're listening to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. U.S. President Joe Biden and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida have announced an upgrade to a bilateral security alliance. The two leaders met in Washington. Joe Biden said the two nations' forces will cooperate on a joint command structure and, along with Australia, develop a new air missile defense network. Kishida said the leaders had agreed to, quote, continue to respond to challenges concerning China, unquote, and would, quote, defend and bolster, unquote, what he described as free and open Indo-Pacific. Chinese Foreign Ministry said the declaration smears China on issues related to the Taiwan Strait and South China Sea and grossly interferes into China's internal affairs. For more, we are joined by Victor Gao, chair professor at Suzhou University. Victor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, the China threat narrative has been a recurring theme in discussions surrounding the U.S.-Japan alliance upgrade. But how much, in your opinion, is the alliance driven by a genuine China threat, or how much by a desire for the U.S. and Japan to bolster their own military power?
Well, first of all, for anything in the bilateral relations between the United States and Japan, if it is aimed at promoting peace and stability, it's their own business, and no country should have any say in that. However, if anything which happens in the bilateral relations between the United States and Japan is actually designed for war preparedness or agitating for war, then it definitely will have an impact on many other countries. Now, part of the reason is that back in August 1945, when Japan unconditionally surrendered, Japan didn't just surrender to the United States. Japan surrendered to China and the former Soviet Union at that time and the United Kingdom. Therefore, the United States should not take unilateral action in its relations with Japan, which may actually change the commitments that Japan undertook when it unconditionally surrendered to China and several other countries. Therefore, when the United States and Japan, back in Washington, are talking about enhancing their strategic and security arrangement with very clearly an aim against China, of course it will be perceived as an increased threat to China, and it is not going to be conducive to greater peace and stability, not only in our part of the world, but throughout the international arena as a whole.
So do you mean this upgrade of alliance between U.S. and Japan represents a fundamental shift in Japan's pacifist stance?
Absolutely, because we know that part of the conditions that Japan agreed to when it unconditionally surrendered in 1945 is that Japan will never engage in acts of aggression and never constitute a threat to the four countries that it surrendered to. And since the end of the Second World War, Japan adopted a pacifist constitution, not allowing Japan's military to move outside the bounds of Japan to engage in overseas adventurism or acts of aggression. That means if the U.S.-Japanese new arrangement will open the door for Japanese military forces to go beyond the boundary of Japan to other parts of the world, constituting a threat to other countries, it is against the spirit and the letter of the pacifist constitution of Japan. And it will not be in the fundamental interest of the Japanese people or even of the American people, because everyone in the United States should be encouraged to always remember Pearl Harbor, and no one in the world of today should pretend to forget the atrocities and the crimes against humanity committed by the Japanese imperialism before they unconditionally surrendered. And if you look closer at Japan-U.S. relations since 1945, Japan actually has been under constant U.S. military occupation. The United States framed it as not occupation of Japan, but as military cooperation. But the reality is that the United States is in control of many important air forces, bases, and the naval bases, and the ground forces bases, for example. And the United States dictates to a very large extent to Japan, and Japan does not have full sovereignty in terms of its military and the political affairs. But therefore, what the United States is doing is not only against the pacifist constitution of Japan, but is really very dangerous and very much of a concern, because it may really free Japan out of the bound that was put onto Japan as part of the condition of its unconditional surrender back in 1945. And then, given the fact that Japan has occupied and invaded so many countries in East Asia, in Southeast Asia, and in many Pacific Island countries, for example, no one should pretend to forget all these atrocities, and no one should indulge in the fantasy that a re-freed Japan, given all the freedom to develop its military forces and aided and abetted by the United States, will remain as a peaceful or pacifist country anymore. It will be viewed as a threat to many countries in this part of the world, and the lesson of history should never be forgotten, especially by the American people who suffered the atrocities of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Several thousands of U.S. troops were killed in the attack on Pearl Harbor. And then many American soldiers and tens of thousands of Chinese troops and tens of millions of civilians in China were slaughtered and killed by the Japanese aggressors before 1945. All these lessons should be kept very much in mind.
Yes, but how does this alliance fit into the broader U.S. strategy of alliances and partnerships in the region, like the Quad and AUKUS? And do you think this is a step towards a kind of formal military bloc against China?
First of all, I think the United States is very much suffering from the combination of two lethal nightmares. On the one hand, the United States is very much worried that China will catch up with the size of the U.S. economy, which China will. If you listen to Elon Musk, he predicts that by the middle of the century, the size of the Chinese economy will be doubling the size of that of the United States. It's something inevitable. The second nightmare Washington is suffering from is that it's very much agitated by its own fear that once China surpasses that of the United States, China will unilaterally impose its values, systems, political ideology onto the United States and pushing the United States out of the center of the global stage. Now, this is not only a complete distortion of facts, it is also a kind of a lethal fantasy that Washington is suffering from. Therefore, I think the United States has been demonstrating and displaying all signs of desperation, hysteria, for example, and agitation. It wants to build up alliance after another alliance. It wants to create new blocs against other blocs. It is really just agitating for a new version of the Cold War, or even a new version of the Hot War. And the United States probably is thinking about which country can be used as a proxy in confronting China, and whether the United States can line up more countries to such a degree that it may actually blackmail China.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, thank you, Victor Gao, chair professor at Suzhou University. You're listening to World Today. Coming up, South Korean Prime Minister offers to resign after election defeat. But what factors have contributed to the ruling party's defeat? We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. South Korea's prime minister and senior presidential officials have offered to resign en masse after the ruling party suffered a crushing defeat in parliamentary elections. Executive power in South Korea is concentrated in the president, but the prime minister will lead the country if the president is unable to work. In a separate announcement, ruling People Power Party leader Han Dong-hyun, who also served as President Yoon Suk-yeol's justice minister, said he would step down as well to take responsibility for the election defeat. The main opposition Democratic Party and its satellite party have won more than 170 seats in the 300-member National Assembly. Yoon will stay in power until he completes his single five-year term in 2027, but Wednesday's elections were seen as a midterm confidence vote on Yoon. Joining us now in the studio is my colleague Ding Heng. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Zhao Yin.
So, what do you make of the election result, and why has the ruling party suffered this defeat?
Basically, voters have shown a strong preference for the opposition candidates to act as a counterbalance to the incumbent administration rather than strengthening the ruling party's position. Well, there were many issues that voters care about in this election, in addition to some of the traditionally important issues like cost of living, the economy, inflation, and even political scandals. There were also some newly emerged issues like President Yoon Suk-yeol's plan to increase medical school admissions. And critics have basically accused Yoon of failing to resolve inflation issues, refusing to fire some controversial top officials within his government, and lacking a sense of communication with the opposition leaders for policy coordination. It looks these things have all had an impact on voters' mindset and mentality. For example, Yoon last month visited a grocery store in Seoul trying to promote his government's efforts to tame food prices, but his comment about the prices of green onion at the time actually ended up inviting more criticism towards him that he was somehow out of touch with the reality, etc. On the medical school admission issue, earlier this year, he actually enjoyed rising approval rating briefly because of his strong push on this particular issue. But later on, doctors' demonstrations and protests and strikes eventually ended up bringing more pressure to Yoon because he faced a growing calls to find a compromise with the demonstrators, because people are really suffering or experiencing some kind of delays of surgeries and other kinds of inconvenience at the local hospitals. So overall, I think this election result was expected by many people in the days leading up to the Wednesday's election.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, since his inauguration in 2022, Yoon Suk-yeol's domestic policies have often faced strong opposition from the National Assembly. The election's result means that the opposition forces will prolong their control of the parliament. So do you think a continuation of a strained relationship between the president and the legislative body is largely expected during the remaining period of Yoon's term?
Yeah, I think that will largely be the case, because President Yoon has had a very, very tense relationship or strained relationship with the legislative body. As of January 2024, only less than 30% of his bills submitted to the National Assembly had been enacted, which is significantly lower than a rate of more than 60% under the previous government. So it's fair to say that on domestic issues, Yoon is really a lame duck president. Many of the key domestic agenda he has outlined to the South Korean people, like increasing housing supply or healthcare reform or some of the building of the major infrastructure programs, I think these issues will continue to face legislative hurdles, and his political opponents will continue to criticize those agenda as a so-called populist policies. Also, we need to keep in mind that there is a newly launched small party, which was led by a former justice minister. And this particular party is actually seen as more progressive than the current main opposition party, and this time around it has won 12 seats in the election. So I think the opposition is likely to increase their political maneuvering to try to weaken President Yoon by, for example, initiating impeachment proceedings against some of the key yet controversial figures within Yoon's government.
Well, actually, through his chief of staff, President Yoon said he will humbly uphold the public sentiments reflected in the election outcome and focus on improving economic situations and reforming state affairs. In the meantime, Lee Jae-myung, leader of the main opposition party, has also said that now the election are over. Both the ruling and opposition parties must pull together all their strength to resolve economic and livelihood problems. So judging from these comments from the two sides, how much optimism is there regarding a possibility of less political division in the country?
I think optimism is actually pretty limited in this regard. These comments you mentioned are only comments because in South Korea, the political divide between conservatives and liberals in general is actually very sharp, and it is actually deepening nowadays. In the campaigns for Wednesday's election, we saw highly, offensive and abusive languages that political rivals have thrown at each other. South Korea remains a largely two-party political system that is closely divided between the two major parties, and Lee Jae-myung is actually the person who competed with President Yoon Suk-yeol back in the 2022 presidential election. That was actually the most closely battled presidential race in the history of South Korea. Basically, Yoon and Lee and their supporters have spent months demonizing each other at the time. So given the fact that Lee Jae-myung is actually eyeing another presidential bid in 2027, you would expect him to continue with his political maneuvering rather than seeking reconciliation with the ruling party.
So will this election outcome have any impact on South Korea's foreign policy?
Well, basically, foreign policy decision-making is mostly in the hands of the presidential office, so I think the impact will be limited. But on the other hand, I think this is also an opportunity maybe for President Yoon to reflect on his foreign policy over the past 2 years or so, because on foreign policy, he has basically followed his campaign pledge in terms of strengthening the alliance with the United States and taking a more hardline position against North Korea. He has also moved to mend the relations with Japan, although that's a very, very controversial issue domestically in South Korea as well. Now, from China's perspective, China does not really oppose South Korea, for example, strengthening ties with the U.S. or Japan. But if somehow that's based on sacrificing Seoul's relations with Beijing, that will be a mistake. Since 2007, South Korea's exports to China have been larger than that to the U.S. and Japan combined. Last year, however, South Korea recorded its first trade deficit with China since the two sides established diplomatic ties in the early 1990s. That was very unfortunate, and South Korea's decision to align with the United States' policy of containing China economically also played a role in that trend in terms of the trade between the two sides. So, given one of the major issues leading to the ruling party's defeat this time around in this particular election is really the economic issue or the inflation issue, I think President Yoon Suk-yeol really needs to pay more attention to managing this ties with China, that's for sure.
Well, thank you, Ding Heng, for being with us. You're listening to World Today. We'll be back. You're listening to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Official data shows that China's consumer price index, the main gauge for inflation, edged up slightly in March from a year earlier. However, it was down 1% from the previous month. The National Bureau of Statistics attributed the changes to seasonal easing of consumer demand and generally sufficient market supply in the month after the Spring Festival. The core CPI deducting food and energy prices went up 0.6% on a yearly basis last month. Meanwhile, the country's producer price index, which measures costs for food at the factory gate, went down 2.8% from a year earlier. This downturn is attributed to the resurgence of industrial activity, resulting in an ample supply of industrial goods and downward pressure on production prices. For more, we are joined by Dr. Yao Shujie, Chengkeng Professor of Economics at Chongqing University. Dr. Yao, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good evening.
So actually, the CPI growth slowed down both year-on-year and month-on-month in March. Can you elaborate on the specific factors contributing to this?
Yes, I think a one-month figure may not tell too much, but a relatively low figure certainly raised some concern on whether the CPI is continuing to going up or it may be sluggish or even going down any further. Certainly, this is a quite optimistic caution in my way, because a low CPI is good for the consumers. It means that the prices are steady. They are, you know, countries where the CPI is too high, people suffer. They have to spend much more money to buy the same goods and services. But in China, the consumer actually benefit to some extent. But why a low figure of CPI, which is good for the consumer, can raise concern for, for the government and also for relevant people is because we are concerned about the economy health in particular. So if the CPI and the PPI are too low, it indicates that the economy recovery or the performance could be a little bit weakening. But if you look at the economy data, for example, like GDP growth and also international trade, this figure for the first 3 months are actually pretty encouraging. So it's very difficult to tell that a slower growth of CPI is indicating a slower economy expansion. So in my view, I think the 1 month figure, we have to wait for another few months to see how it goes. And the underlying reason for this low figure is probably due to the continual adjustment of the housing market, which affected consumers' expenditure in many fields. So we have to consider whether the housing market is going to pick up in the near future or not.
Yes, but core CPI, excluding food and energy, remained moderately positive. Do you see this trend continuing throughout this year?
Yeah, I think in general, because the Chinese economy is still expanding with a reasonable growth rate, so I would suspect that the CPI will continue to increase. How much it increased, we cannot see now. Look at this a couple of months figure. But I believe that the CPI will continue to increase, although it may not be as far as people anticipate.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the meantime, the PPI went down 2.8% from a year earlier. What do you think are the main factors contributing to this trend?
Yeah, it reflects probably the weakening of the economic growth in general, and also some sort of structural adjustment in the industrial sector. Some sectors are overproducing, which have a fairly strong downward pressure on the producer prices. Basically, manufacturers produce a lot of things they cannot sell instantly, so what they need to do is to reduce the price. And I hope that this trend would be come to an end at some point, but at the moment, it means that there will be still some time for this painful adjustment. And whatever it is, as I mentioned, again, it's the housing sector, which is still in the negative territory, and it affected many upstream and downstream sectors, those sectors would certainly have some effect on the producer prices. But again, we have to wait and see how this trend will continue. 2.8% is quite a significant negative figure, but it's not disastrous in the sense that it is quite stable for the last few months.
Yes, well, actually, Goldman Sachs has raised its forecast for China's economic growth for both the first quarter and the full year of 2024, citing the country's manufacturing strength. How do you look at this upward revision?
Yes, you look at last year figures, people are fairly concerned that China will continue to grow as strong as last year or even more this year. But you look at the performance of the first 3 months, it means that Chinese manufacturing are picking up, investment in the manufacturing sector is increasing, and Chinese export is doing fairly well, 8.7% for the first 2 months of this year of falling trade. So all the macroeconomy indicators for the first few months have some very encouraging signals. I just hope that the rest of the year, those macroeconomic indicators will continue to be strong. And that depends largely on the manufacturing sector, on the service sector. Of course, the agriculture sector also must be very steady. And this, China is recovering after the pandemic, and it will take time to get into the fairly steady state.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, we are seeing this emphasis on new quality productive forces. How do you think this is going to contribute to China's long-term economic growth?
The new quality productive forces is the concept raised by President Xi Jinping last fall in Heilongjiang. And I think it become a fairly important concept. Most people are paying attention to this new concept. New productive forces means that China is actually upgrading the industrial systems so that China will become more competitive and will depend less on the traditional industry and more on the emerging and future industries. For example, the new energy vehicles, the new battery, and also the photovoltaic panels and so on, China is doing very well, but there are some other things. China is, for example, like Internet of Things and automation driving and so on, artificial intelligence. Those would increase the overall labor productivity and would increase China's international competitiveness so that enable China to transform from a middle-income country to a high-income country in the future.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Yao Shujie, Changkun Professor of Economics at Chongqing University. You're listening to World Today. Stay with us. You're listening to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. The competition in China's live streaming e-commerce sector is fiercer as a leading player has announced an expansion plan. JD.com will invest 1 billion yuan, or nearly $140 million, to compete with companies like Douyin, Kuaishou, and WeChat for a wider pool of video content creators. According to statistics, 70% of Chinese netizens have made purchases after watching short videos or live streams, and 40% of users agree that short videos and live streams have become their main consumption channels. For more, my colleague Xu Yawen spoke with Dr. Zhou Mi, a senior research fellow with the Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economics.
Dr. Zhou, JD.com rolled out a live shopping service back in 2016, and just 7 months after Alibaba's Taobao, it was not until 2 years later that short video giants Douyin and Kuaishou added shopping to their video content. However, unlike other apps, JD.com failed to cultivate any star influencers, and this time, the company says it's actively preparing to incubate the top creators in order to attract more influencers and high-quality content to its platform. So, what's your overall impression and assessment of JD's strategy? Do you think it's a bit too late, maybe, to heavily invest in the market that's already very competitive?
Yeah, we know that JD is a very different the giant in the digital economy compared with other suppliers. Maybe it has its own special characteristics about the shopping, trying to make the logistics quicker and gain also the confidence of many consumers. So, I mean, it has its own special groups of persons. And when we discuss about the digital economy, everyone is competing for the data entrance. I think that Jingdong has a very good base for connecting different kind of persons and trying to expand its market. But I have to say that it still depends on what kind of strategies JD will going to do, because if they are just to try to do the same thing like Douyin and Kuaishou or other giants, maybe it's not so workable. So we know that the digital market, there are so many new changes about the people who are dealing with these apps or who are going to be involved in these things. So I mean, that it will never be too late to start to have more, trial on these kind of, the things to expand a special market. Well, it is also a good news because we know that for the consumers, they are able to get more content, and some of them are very different from others. I think that consumers can benefit from this competition, and also it will give some pressures to Douyin and Kuaishou for them to improve their quality for giving better services to the consumers.
If we look at this in a broader picture, China's live streaming e-commerce market exceeded 3.4 trillion yuan in 2022 and reached nearly 5 trillion yuan in 2023, representing a growth rate of 35%. What factors contributed to the remarkable growth of China's live streaming e-commerce market, and how sustainable do you think it's going to be?
I think that when we're talking about the potentials of a China's market, it is still based on the two factors. The first one is how many people, the proportion of the consumers are connected with e-commerce. I mean, that is increased very quickly in the recent years, and a lot of consumers, no matter where they are able to buy the things from the e-commerce platforms. Well, on the second factor, I would say that is the cost of using these e-commerce platforms. We know that when we are trying to make some decisions, we are not only looking at its prices, we are still trying to find out how quick can we get the products we are going to buy, and is the quality of these products guaranteed by the providers, or if there are some problems with these products we bought, can we find some ways to protect our benefits? So I think that is also a lot of things that e-commerce platforms are trying to deal with. They are setting up some kind of disciplines and trying to make it more reliable for the providers. And also the competition are there, and a lot of competitions are just existing in the industrial systems. And I would say that is also good for us to improve the manufacturing, efficiency. So for the sustainability, I still believe that there are a lot of more potentials for China to develop, because we are not only trying to cover the market, but also trying to provide the consumers with better quality products. And that is what they are going to have and have the willingness to consume.
Dr. Zhou, a recent report shows the growth in online audiovisual users is primarily coming from rural areas in China. For example, in 2022 and in 2023, the number of online audiovisual users in the rural area reached nearly 300 million and 320 million respectively, with year-on-year growth rates of 12% and 7% respectively. These growth rates significantly outpaced those of urban users during the same period. So what are your thoughts on these figures? Do you believe this trend has also contributed to the robust growth of the live streaming e-commerce market in the country?
Definitely. I believe that is one of the very important areas that many e-commerce platforms are trying to compete with. We know the rural areas are one of China's priorities for development. So we have put so many forces on the, improve the infrastructure and logistics in the rural areas, trying to make the people living there have a better life. So this provided so many new opportunities for those providers trying to get more market share. I think that is also one of the reasons that we are seeing that the improvement of the infrastructure, like for the telecommunications, and also the delivery systems are developed much quicker than the urban areas. And that is also a good news for, you know, many of the countries in the world. They can provide better choices. Like we know that many of the foreign wine producers, they are trying to sell their wines to the rural areas in China. And it is very, you know, potential for the increase of the development. So I would argue that if we are looking at the future, maybe it is a very good choice for the platform operators to try to find better, you know, understanding the taste of the rural areas people, and they are, you know, having more opportunities to consume the same thing as the urban people.
And lastly, Dr. Zhou, we have noticed that the live streaming e-commerce is very popular in China and also in some Southeast Asian nations. However, why hasn't this type of business got significant growth overseas, particularly in countries such as in America and also in some European nations?
Yeah, it is a very good question. You know, when we are trying to develop the e-commerce, many of our practices or, you know, experiences are learned from the Western countries. Well, it is not the same. Maybe, I mean, from the structure of the, you know, society to organizing the different stakeholders' participation roles. So for China, we are very good at the labor. So we have so many people who are able to try to be involved in the delivery systems. And for many of these countries, in the Western countries, they are not so good at the labors. And the second, I would say that China's government have sent a very clear signal that it is very good for us to improve the e-commerce. So many companies trying to, you know, organize their resources and be involved in these areas. Well, the third one, I would say that it is because of the competition. In China, we have many of these innovation-based companies, platforms, and also with a lot of SMEs. So they have many potentials for us to develop. And the marginal benefit for the investors to be involved in the e-commerce is much larger than other sectors or industries. So this also encourages a lot of investment to go into this regard. And we are also trying to establish better ways for the trade facilitation, like for the tariffs and the clearance of the clearance of the international trade. That is also beneficial for the development of e-commerce in China.
That is Dr. Zhou Mi, senior researcher with the Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economics, speaking with Xiao Wen. And that's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Thanks for listening. See you next time.